Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
I promised you Fevzi Turkalp. He is, of course, the gadget detective. He is here to take your questions. If you've got any issues to do with your gadgets, if you're looking at advice on what kind of technology to buy, replace, repair, no question is a bad question. No question too dumb for Fevzi to answer, as he always says. 0500 909 693 is the number to give Fevzi a call. You can text as well, 85058, and we'll usually try and give you a call back. Fevzi, apologies for delaying you. Welcome to Up All Night. How are you, sir?
Morning. Yes, good. Riveting stuff. So
Yeah, no, it's an interesting result. It is an interesting result. There's quite a lot of technology news going on at the minute. I might talk to you about Nokia in a little bit, but let's talk about routers if we can, because we've been covering it in our news tonight. People have heard it through the day on 5 Live, this attack on routers from some firms. How worried should people be about that?
It is a problem. I mean, our routers are... So for those that are uninitiated, the router is the box that is the first point at which the internet comes into your home. So it comes in typically via your phone line. It goes into the router, and then the router disseminates the internet either by wires or wirelessly around your home or office. And that device is in itself a dedicated computer, and it runs a version of the Linux operating system. And as a computer with an operating system, it is liable to be hacked like any other computer. And there have been various pieces of malware doing the rounds recently, variations on something called the Mirai worm, that get into those devices, and basically they can be controlled, they can be shut down. So if they want to shut all of those machines down, tell them to turn themselves off effectively, then those homes and offices all lose their internet connection.
It's a slightly worrying one. A question for you on text, Fevzi, this one 85058, and this sort of on a similar theme when it comes to security and home internet and that kind of thing. It's a bit of a personal one. Feel free perhaps not to answer in such personal terms, but the questioner, who doesn't leave a name, says, do you cover your built-in webcam because of security issues? I know this is something that's come up. I think the boss of the NSA has said that he sticks tape over his...
black tape.
His webcam, because he's worried about people taking it over.
That's exactly what I do, and I stick a bit of blue tack on the microphone as well. So, yes, is a short answer. Because usually when a webcam comes on, there's a little light next to it called a tally light, and you can tell when the camera is active because the light comes on, and at least that is some form of protection. Well, the problem with that is it is possible to write software, and the software exists, that on many machines can switch on a webcam without any light coming on. There being no visual or audible indication that the webcam is active. Similarly for the microphone as well. And this is not just a problem with, you know, desktop or laptop PCs. There are also, unfortunately, issues with regard to malware that runs on our smartphones. Much harder to stick a piece of tape over your smartphone camera, but it's something that you need to be aware of. There are active mics live in all over our homes. I know you were saying recently that you were quite fond of the Amazon Echo.
Recently got an Amazon Echo. We demonstrated it on the show.
There are seven beam-forming microphones on top of that. So, and interestingly, there's a button that you can press to switch the mics off. But if you wanted to be really bells and braces about it, and you wanted to say something sensitive in front of Alexa, you pull the plug. If you really want to be sure about it. So, yes, and I don't think it's paranoid. It's interesting that those who know, such as people who work in the NSA and so forth, have said that this is exactly what they do. It's not a complete protection, but it's a good step. And interestingly, some webcams now come with little visors on them that you can flip down.
A sort of built-in bit of sticky tape almost. Slightly more elegant solution to
high
the problem.
High-tech sticky tape. Yeah, it's a good idea. You should do it.
Here's a question for you from Marty in Hertfordshire, who says, bizarrely, my Sony Bravia remote also turns off my Panasonic in another room and vice versa. Why? Arg! Can I do anything, or is the infrared bouncing around the glass windows and doors, perhaps? Is there any way we can stop it?
Yes. I mean, normally, certainly on the Sonys, you can normally choose different standards, if you like, that it can broadcast from. So you can actually change it so that it uses something a little bit different, so that it shouldn't interfere with others. It shouldn't anyway, but sometimes, you know, there is some overlap. So particularly things like the on-off button on the remote can sometimes lead to other devices waking up or switching off. So you can usually do it, and it's a good idea to do. If you get really stuck, then you can try and solve the problem by getting a sort of one for all type remote and programming that separately again to use slightly different codes.
I've had to do the same thing, actually. Slightly stupidly, I bought two of exactly the same sort of Freeview box that are in two rooms on the same floor of my house. So if I get the angle just right, it bounces down the corridor and it affects both boxes at once. So I ended up buying this universal programmable remote. So whether they don't have the range or not, I don't know, but it seems to have solved the problem. So.
Yeah, sometimes it's just subtle differences that will solve the problem. The problem, I mean, it's bad enough with a standard remote, which uses an infrared beam, which basically needs line of sight. But a lot of remotes now, particularly to things like set-top boxes and stuff, they use radio frequencies, sometimes Bluetooth or
rather
other
than
standards. And again, you can sometimes have issues. It's less common, but when you do get that's more problematic, because those beams don't require line of sight and can affect devices in the next room.
Briar's given us a call on 0500 909 693. Briar, good morning. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you.
You have a problem with your doorbell.
Well, I do. Now, it started because I have an office for my work at the top of the house, and as I work at home, lots of my neighbours have parcels delivered, especially this time of year, and so I'm rushing up and down the stairs, nearly breaking my neck to get to the door, and the man's rushed off with the parcel because he doesn't want to wait for me to get down the stairs. So
oh, yes.
I thought, right, I'm going to get one of these video doorbells. So they push the bell, it then sends a message to my iPhone or my iPad, which I have, and I can see who they are, and I can say to them, wait there, I'll come down and pick up the parcel. So I've bought this, it's called a smart bell. Mm-hmm. I think it's made in China, so it has rather obscure and odd instructions. But I get so far in the process, but what I cannot get it to do, because it's a Wi-Fi setup, I cannot get the camera bell to link to my Wi-Fi. It just does not show the network at all. I looked online to see if there are any other comments, and somebody talked about setting it up as a personal hotspot, but on their router. But when I phoned, they said, no, that's your phone with this personal hotspot, and that doesn't work either. Help, Febsey. You're the only person I know who might have any kind of answer.
No pressure
No pressure.
in principle, your Wi-Fi router is a personal hotspot, and your phone can become a personal hotspot. So a hotspot is where a device has an internet signal coming in, which it can then disseminate by wireless means, typically by Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. So obviously a router can do that. That's kind of what it does. But also mobile phones can do that. I would say, look, the issue is this. If on your smartphone or tablet you cannot even see that Wi-Fi signal, then there's something badly wrong. I mean, it would be one thing to say, oh, well, I can see it, but I don't know the password to log on to it and access it and pair with it. But whether you can do a sort of ad hoc point-to-point connection, I doubt that the doorbell has that sophistication. And I would suggest that if you can't even see it, so when you go into your did you say it was an iPhone?
Febsey, if you'll bear with me, I'll take one step back just so, because with IT, it's like, you have to follow the steps very carefully. And I don't think this makes any difference at all, but part of the process is to take, obviously, connect the phone to know the identity of the doorbell.
Yes.
And it has a QR code thing on the back of the camera, mm-hmm. which, when photographed by the iPhone, mm-hmm. picks up the right identity for the camera. I don't think that makes any difference to picking up the Wi-Fi, but I just thought you should know that just in case you suddenly said, aha! Well, so we're still in the same place, which is it doesn't seem to see the network, any network of any kind. What it just says, it says it's connecting, and then it says the camera is not online.
Okay, so I understand, and thank you for that. I don't think the QR code, the smart code, is going to help us. So with the smart bell, it's a Wi-Fi device, like any other. When you go into an iPhone or an iPad, you go into your settings, you go to the Wi-Fi section, you should see a list of Wi-Fi networks that it can see. Yeah. One of those should identify itself as a smart bell device. When you tap on it, it should then prompt you for a password. I took the opportunity to have a sneaky look online, and I'm disgusted to see that the default password for this device is 123456789. I only hope that you're able to change that once you do get this going.
Yes, definitely.
That's appalling. But are you seeing the smart bell in the list of networks under the Wi-Fi section of your
settings? That's an incredibly good question, because the answer is, I presumed it would come up on the screen of my phone, which is what it does when you look at the videos online, giving you there's one that refers or two that refers to this particular model. But it doesn't say to go into my Wi-Fi settings on my phone to look. So the answer is...
The first thing you have, because there are Wi-Fi... I'm sorry to interrupt you. I cut across you. I apologize. So because there are a multiplicity of Wi-Fi devices typically in a domestic setting, you know, your neighbors, and it's amazing how far sometimes, you know, Wi-Fi signals can reach, even from, you know, down the back of your garden, the houses on the other road sometimes can creep their way in. So you then have to tell it which ones you're interested in, and by default, even if you wish, allow them to lock onto it automatically whenever they see that signal in the future. But the first time, you have to tap on it. So you go into settings, you go Wi-Fi, you tap on...
I've got my phone in front of me while you're talking to me.
You tap on it there.
It's showing
then,
my fizzy box.
Yeah, it should then...
And it's showing my next-door neighbour.
Yeah.
But isn't showing... And the camera, it's not plugged in. So it's...
Right, okay. So if it doesn't appear in that list...
Yeah.
That tells us that it's not emitting a valid Wi-Fi signal. Therein lies the problem, unless it's a specific setting. You would think as soon as it's powered, it should be broadcasting that signal. But obviously refer to the manual just in case it's something that has to be switched on.
The manual is so badly written, it's not decipherable at all. But I think what I might do is, given it's the middle of the night, it's ridiculous, I shouldn't be talking to you, I should be fast asleep, ready for work tomorrow. What I might do is... plug the thing in again, because it's next in the room next door to me.
Yes.
Plug it in and see if my iPhone will pick up that network, because I wasn't looking at it like that.
Yeah.
And if it does, I'll ring back and tell you.
Then, you see, if it does, then you tap on it. It will prompt you for a password, which regressively is 123456789. Get it working and then change it as soon as you can. If it is baked in and it doesn't allow you to change that password, send it back. It's not fit for purpose, and we've just alluded to devices that are being, you know, hijacked, and this sort of this is what's known as an Internet of Things type device, devices that attach to the internet but they're not conventional computers. These devices are very easy to hack, and where they've got these sort of standard passwords which either cannot be changed or no one changes, you know, they are very vulnerable. So if it's not possible to change it, that's a reason to take it back in my book. However, if it works, set it up. If you can change the password, do so, and it should work fine. But if it is not even appearing in that list when you go to settings, Wi-Fi, and then choose network, then you've got a problem, because it's not actually broadcasting. Make sure that there's nothing that you have to do to get it to broadcast, but it could just be a faulty unit at that point.
Brian, thank you very much for giving us a call. Let us know how you get on. Fevzy to the rescue. Speaking of calls, 0500 909 693 is the number to dial, and that is exactly what Ralph has done. Ralph, good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
How are things with you, Ralph? Everything running all right with your PC?
It's running slow, that's why I'm calling, actually.
Well, there you go, then. Well, Fevzy's there for you. Ask away.
OK, hello, Fevzy.
Morning, Ralph.
Right, I hope it's a simple problem. My PC keeps telling me the CPU usage monitor on Task Manager tells me that my CPU is using 100%.
Yep.
But I'm only running... in fact, I've tried it running no applications, yep, and it will still say 100%.
That's a bit of a worry, isn't it? And is this a relatively recent thing? Has it slowed over time, or did it suddenly happen?
I guess it's a relatively recent thing, Fassi, but it's just perplexing. Like, I don't understand it.
I understand.
When I look at what programs what applications are running, it says things like svchost.exe.
Yeah, that's normal. That's part of Windows, so don't worry about that.
Okay, but that's running at 40-odd%.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. How old is the machine?
Less than 2 years.
Less than so it's quite a modern, and it's running which version of Windows, if I may ask?
You, of course you can. It's Windows 7 Home Premium. I tried to update it to Windows 10, but for some reason it wouldn't take.
Okay, well, probably you may have dodged a bullet in some way. So not that Windows 10 is bad, but it comes with a whole set of problems sometimes when you upgrade it, which aren't always worth the benefits that Windows 10 brings you over 7. So I'd suggest, you know, that you don't try that again. You know, maybe when you get a new machine, you try it. So, Ralph, this machine's less than 2 years old. I'm guessing it has a reasonably good spec for a machine of that age and should be easily capable of running Windows 7. If it is suddenly showing that the CPU is spiking in that way, it is possible that there are other processes, i.e. parts of programs running in the background that don't even come up on the standard Windows screen that shows you which processes are running. I'm talking about, you know, viruses and types of malware. So it's possible, and we need to check for this first, because obviously if it is the case, that's potentially very serious. So are you running any sort of antivirus and security package on your system?
Yes, I am. I've had a couple, in fact, seen. Also, just so you know, less than a year ago, I had it professionally cleaned and debugged and thoroughly checked out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a good thing, but that was, you know, that's a year ago, and a device can get infected, you know, from one day to the next. So I would suggest what you need to do as a first step is to do a full system scan. Which antivirus are you using?
One that comes as part of the BT package, but it's run by McAfee.
Okay. Not my favourite choice, but it will do the job well enough for this purpose. So you need to boot up the computer. That's to say, restart the computer in what's called safe mode. Safe mode is a sort of stripped down diagnostic mode of Windows where anything that doesn't absolutely need to run in the background isn't running. And the reason why that's important is if there are viruses that come to life every time you switch on the computer and beaver away in the background eating up your CPU cycles, then with luck they shouldn't be running. So the first thing is, let's see what the CPU utilization is like, i.e. the CPU usage is like, when you boot up into safe mode. And the way that you do that in Windows 7 is you tap the F8, the function 8 key, as you switch it on. You tap it every couple of seconds until, instead of seeing the Windows normal colorful window screen, you will see a black screen with white writing on it. That is safe mode. It won't look pretty, but it is Windows. First of all, let's see if the machine springs somewhat to life. Once it's in that mode, then you do a full system scan. That's to say, you allow your antivirus program to do a check file by file, every file on the system, with a minimized risk that the virus is running in the background interfering with your antivirus program. Because if you run it in normal mode, some malware, some viruses are programmed to attack and disable, in effect, antivirus programs. So you do it in that mode, you do a full system scan. If you haven't got a solid state drive in there, it may take a couple of hours or so to run all the way through. That's fine. I'd leave the device offline whilst you're doing that, by the way. Make sure that you've updated the antivirus to the latest version and the latest definitions, as it were. Then pull the cord, switch off the Wi-Fi, and let it chug away in that way. And let's see if it finds anything. If it doesn't, then we can then look at how Windows has been installed and whether we need to change any settings. But I think the urgent thing is to check for that. And I would be inclined also maybe to try, if that comes up clean, maybe to try one or two other antivirus scanning tools. And there are ones that will do it online for you. Obviously, you'd have to go back online to do that. But the problem with antivirus software is you can't install and run contemporaneously more than one, because they don't sit well together. They try and grab the same file at the same time, and it causes terrible problems. But you can have one installed, as you do now, and then you can run others through, you know, online, and just allow a couple of them to check. And I'd use something like Symantec, Norton, or Kaspersky, or ESET, E-S-E-T. Any of those are excellent and would make a good secondary or tertiary scan. So do that. Okay. And the reason why that's important, obviously, is if there is an infection, that could explain why, you know, your CPU is belting away even though you don't seem to be doing anything. Because even if Windows is grabbing 40%, which is very high, that still doesn't explain quite where the other 60% is going. Right. So that's my concern. And if that is the case, we've got to get that cleaned. If you think that anything has infected your computer, you're going to need to start changing passwords, starting with the password for your email account. And ideally, you would do that from a machine that you believe to be safe and clean.
Right, okay. Can I just mention, if it helps you, the other thing that seems to be taking up a lot of space on the CPU is called wmpnetwk.exe.
Okay, don't know what that is off the top of my head. I mean, you can Google for these things and see, you know, whether it's a component of Windows or a component of one of this piece of software. But
okay.
I think, I look, you know, if it comes up clean on the scan, yes, by all means, let's go in and research those things. But I think such is the importance of making sure that your machine is clean before we take time with anything else. That's the place I'd go first. The reason I say that is, and the reason I mention your email, Ralph, is this. If someone has access to your machine, if they've infected your machine, it's not just that your machine is what they call a zombie, as part of a botnet, which is this group of computers around the world that are controlled by some miscreant or other. It is because they can then do anything at your computer that you can do as if you were sitting at the keyboard, including access your emails. And why is that important? Other than the content of the emails themselves, it is because every website that you've ever registered with will have an option to say, I forgot my password, please email me a reset code. They could go to a multiplicity of sites. There are programs that will scan all the common sites, try and log on using your credentials, press the button to say send me a reset code, activate the reset code, delete the email so you don't know it's ever happened, lock you out of your own email account, and then proceed to access your payment details, your bank details, and everything else. So this is why there's an urgency. Whenever there is a suspicion that your machine may be infected, you have to take that seriously, and you have to deal with that as a priority. After that, it's just a tech problem, not a fraud problem.
I might have a solution. I've done a bit of Googling. As you suggested, I did a bit of Googling what Ralph was saying there. Thank on you. WMPNETWK, is Windows Media Player Network. According to Google, it's the service that Windows Media Player runs that shares your media library over a network. I think it's a thing that runs by default on Windows Media Player. And there are a lot of people contacting forums all over the internet saying it is tying up all of my system resources. So it seems like it's a relatively common problem. So maybe if you have a quick Google around that, there's a few suggestions on there on how to disable that network sharing service, and that may solve the issue.
Yeah.
Something I've encountered myself, actually, it's a Windows Media Player, is a bit of a resource hog when it comes to that. It's sort of constantly polling the network to see if other machines want to play media off your device.
Isn't it interesting and fortunate, therefore, that Microsoft have unbundled it from Windows 10 so you don't get it anymore?
Yes, exactly. As I say, it's... Ralph, thanks very much for giving us a call. Still more time with Fevzy. And Fevzy, we're going to go into extra time. We'll do another half hour because we've interrupted you so much, if that's all right with you. So you've got Fevzy until half past three. 0500 909 693 is the number to call. And Martin in Aldershot has been waiting very patiently, having given us a call on that number. Martin, thank you for being so patient and waiting to talk to Fevzy. What's your question, sir?
No problem at all. I've got a Wi-Fi router, Fevzy.
Yep.
And I understood from the before the program began that you were going to talk about passwords on that Wi-Fi router.
Yes.
It came with the default password. Do you think that's secure enough?
No, because the default passwords are published online, and often when your Wi-Fi router announces itself, it often by default announces what make and model of router it is, which is pretty devastating. By the way, if you're going into your router settings to change the password, it might be an idea to change its what's called an SSID, the way in which it identifies itself as a network.
That is the SSID I'm talking about, but I'm also talking about a password that I enter to access the router.
Yeah, no, that's right. So the password that you enter to access the router is what decrypts or decodes the data that is sent between your device, be it a laptop or a tablet, for example, and the router. So that information is encoded or encrypted, and it's decrypted.
So that should be fairly safe. Yeah.
Yeah. So but you need to change it, because if you are just using the default password. Yes, so it could be referred to as, say, a WPA password, for example, or WEP, preferably WPA or WPA2.
WPA, yeah.
Right, okay. That's better than WEP in terms of the security.
Yes.
You should not leave it on the default, because what it means is that anyone sitting outside your house with a laptop or a tablet or a smartphone could detect your Wi-Fi signal, realize what sort of router you're using from the SSID, and look up online what's the default password for that router, and then they're on your system. And it's not just that they...
I thought every router came with its own default password. Is that not the case?
It can be the case, but some routers, it is a default for the make and model. Do you see what I mean?
I fully understand.
So you need to change. Yes. The WPA password should be changed from the default, because it could be, dare I say it, the word password. I mean, some of them do default to that. So you really...
No, that it's not defaulted to that. It's a very complicated password. If you pull out the little socket at the back,
right,
the actual password is can't do it now, but
yeah, but it's underneath the box. Yes, and it's unique. That sounds like it's I'm sorry, carry on.
No, I was going to say it's on the back of the box.
Yeah,
and if I pull it out, it looks like a very complicated password, you know, involving letters, numbers, everything like that.
I mean, that sounds better. That sounds like it's not a default password. It's the password that came on your particular box.
Exactly.
I personally would still change it, but I would, because there's no harm in changing it. And for one thing, what it prevents is anyone who's got access in your home picking up the box and reading the password off it. Admittedly, that's less likely. Yeah. Okay. I mean, personally, I would change it because there's no harm. And I would also change that SSID identification as well, so that it doesn't announce itself for what it is. And if you really want to be smart, you put another make and model of router in the SSID, just to confuse anyone who decides they want to be clever.
Right, that's a really good idea. Yeah, thank you.
So I would do that. It's not that it's necessarily using the default for the make and model, but still, there's no harm in changing it. You know, from time to time, it's a good idea to refresh your passwords, even the one in your router. By the way, another tip I would give you with regards to your router is, every now and then, and by that I mean once a week, once every couple of weeks, once a month maybe, unplug it and plug it back in. There's two reasons for that.
I've done that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll just share this with you, but also for our listener. The reason for that is twofold. One is, when you do that, it gives the router an opportunity to download the latest version of the software that it runs internally, in what's known as firmware. That's the software that gives it some functionality. Because, for example, we talked earlier about this TalkTalk post office router hack. Those hacks took advantage of a vulnerability in the internal software of the router, and it may be that actually it affected the older versions of the router whose software hadn't been updated. I'm not sure in this particular case, but as a general rule of thumb, if you plug and unplug your router from time to time, you give it the opportunity.
I'm sorry to interrupt again, but could I tell you where my router is from?
Sure.
It's BT.
Yeah. Okay, well, that doesn't change the principle of plugging and unplugging it, because, unfortunately, these updates
I have done that, because the router does, I know when you re-plug it in, it connects to the local exchange, does DHCP, and picks up a new internet address, yeah?
Yes.
IP address, rather. And so, therefore, that makes you a little bit less vulnerable. Is that correct?
Yeah, in the sense that you've got a different IP address, it's not a static IP, so it makes it slightly less likely that you get hacked. That's one possible benefit, but it's also a good idea just to refresh the machine from time to time, allow it to update if there is an update available, and just make sure that it's running as smoothly as possible. Once every couple of weeks, once a month, it's a quick process.
Martin, if it's any help, I have a BT router. I have to unplug mine about once every 2 days to get it to restart, so it's not the worst thing in the world. It's a bit of a pain in the backside, but I've had to do it with every router I've ever had. And Fevzi, what have we covered already? We've done router passwords, we've done dodgy doorbells, we've done unnecessary CPU usage. Should we go through a few of the people who've texted us on 85058?
Sure.
Because there's lots of people waiting for answers to their text. Lewis in Leicester says, could you help me? I'm after an Android tablet that has fast internet browsing for around £100. I don't want the Amazon Fire because it's riddled with ads.
Yes, and also Amazon Fire runs a version of Android which they don't call Android, they call it Fire OS, and it's what's called a forked version. In other words, it had a common heritage, it had a common heritage, but it's sort of the roses forked and it's gone its own way. So although it's possible to sideload Android apps on it, it's not a bog standard one. So for about £100, I would look at tablets from the likes of Samsung, LG, sometimes some of the Sonys, which tend to be a little bit more expensive, but if you go back a generation, that will work well. In terms of internet speed, there isn't a huge difference. What will help things along is having a reasonable processor with a reasonable amount of RAM memory inside it as well. So that will take a little bit of research, because one of the things that slows tablets down a lot is because they tend to have less RAM. That's the type of memory that it uses to run programs in and operate its own system. Because those machines, tablets, tend to have less memory than, say, a laptop or a desktop computer, but they're still multitasking, they're allowing you to run more than one app at a time. The problem that you often get with tablets that don't have enough RAM is that they shut down the apps that are in the background, which means that when you go back to them, they have to restart. So I'll give you an example. I have this problem with the first generation iPad mini. The processor is still fast enough. There is still enough storage. It has 64 gigabytes of storage, plenty for what I use it for, but it only has half a gigabyte of RAM in it, which means that when I leave my email program, I come back to it, it has to reload it. And that's what really slows you down in tablet use. It's not necessarily the power of the processor or the speed at which it attaches to the internet. It is whether it needs to keep reloading applications and trying to remember where it was up to. That's a very slowing process. So that would be my advice. I'd go for one of the established brands. At £100, you don't need to go for one of the sort of no-name devices that you can get. I don't think it's worth saving £30 to do that. If you've got a £100 budget, that should be sufficient.
Yeah, there used to be the Tesco Huddle, didn't there? That was very popular and a very reasonable price. They stopped that, didn't they?
Well, the Huddle is the Huddle too.
Yeah.
They're still around, but again, probably better suited to children and better suited to people who are particularly fond of buying from Tesco, because it's quite well integrated.
It's tied into their ecosystem.
Interestingly, the same with the Amazon Fire tablets. They're great devices if you like the Amazon ecosystem. If for example, you like reading Kindle ebooks, now you can get an ebook reader for standard Android or iOS for the Apple devices, but the Kindle version of the Amazon version of the Kindle ebook reader, which runs on their tablets, has text to speech built into it, which is missing from the iOS and Android apps. So if you want it to be able to read to you, albeit in a robotic voice, That feature, interestingly, it used to exist in certainly in the Apple version, and I believe the Android as well, and they removed it, and I think that was a way both to sell their devices and also to push their Audible talking books.
Of course, yeah, it's a competing service that they also own, isn't it?
Yes.
Where you can subscribe and you download an audiobook every month.
Which, by the way, you can run on your Echo if you get any Audible books.
I've tried that. It's very, very exciting. You just tell it to read a book and then it reads The Martian to
and
you.
And also you can just tell it to shut itself down after 15 minutes.
Sort of sleep timer.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we won't keep going on about my Echo because we played
voice,
it last time.
But a voice-activated sleep timer, which for a bedroom device, I think is really nice.
It is very exciting. Other similar competing devices are available. It's Google Home, isn't there, in various things. So we shouldn't feel like we're over-promoting them.
There
Amazon
are,
Echo, but
it is
pretty cool.
You can also chance your arm with Siri as well if you've got one of the iPhones with a speaker on it, decent speaker, you can actually use that as well.
Question from a first-time listener who's not left their name, but a first-time texter, I should say, a listener who's not left their name. This is somebody who has a Canon laser printer and bought compatible but much cheaper ink, but it now won't work. Is that a coincidence, or do I have to get Canon ink?
Okay, so if you're talking about a laser printer, then you're not talking about ink strictly. You're talking about toner, which is these microfine particles which get fused through heat to the surface of the paper, which is why it doesn't smudge, because it's actually plastic that's fused to the surface to form characters on the page. So assuming we're talking about a toner cartridge, any of these compatibles. There's different types of compatibles. So you have the original toner cartridges. You then have what are known as remanufactured toner cartridges, where it was an original cartridge, but it's been refilled either by the manufacturer or by a third party. Those are, often the safer bet of the sort of non-new options.
Yeah.
And then you've got the completely third-party ones where the casing and the toner is manufactured. It's never ideal, and the problem is that if it has ceased working directly after that, then one has to be suspicious, and it's also possible that you may have invalidated your warranty. If you still have a warranty, or certainly if it's certainly within 2 years, you have some consumer rights, and even up to 6 years, you have some rights under the Sale of Goods Act. So I think it's worth chancing your arm. The problem is that the toner cartridges are often very expensive compared to the cost of a new printer.
Yeah.
So you don't really then want to be going out and buying another one. Plus, if you start removing toner cartridges that are not empty, it can increase the amount of toner dust that goes into the air, and that can sometimes be carcinogenic. So you need to make sure you follow any instructions for replacing toner cartridges very carefully. And also, just as a general piece of advice, we use laser printers at home where we don't usually have air conditioning, and you need to use a laser printer in a well ventilated space, both because they tend to produce little puffs of these particulate matter, but also because they tend to produce a gas called ozone. Which again, although that breaks down after time, you know the smell that you sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm saying this as somebody who has a laser printer sat on a windowsill right next to my computer in my office, which is a room that has absolutely no ventilation whatsoever.
No, that's not ideal. Actually, as a piece of general advice, there are inkjet printers now, which are every bit as good. I've got an inkjet printer sitting right next to me that is faster than any laser printer that I've ever used, and cheaper to run, and doesn't smudge. It does 70 pages a minute, and it's an inkjet, and it's cheap to run. So there are solutions out there that don't require you to have a laser printer. I'm not trying to suggest that they are the curse of death, but there are. Well, if you look in the manual, and I know most of us just set these things up.
I'm not a manual reader. No.
Well, yeah, I mean, if most of us read the manuals on our mobile phones, we might think twice about how we use them as well. I mean, there are a lot of disclaimers in mobile phone manuals.
Do you even get a manual with a mobile phone these days?
Well, if you don't get a paper one, if you read it.
It's all online, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, there's usually the bit that says, don't use it in the way that we all use it, because it could kill you later. That sort of idea. There's some data. But if you're going to use a laser printer in particular in a home situation where it's not an air-conditioned office and it's not near a window and so forth. You must follow the instructions, both in terms of how much space it needs around it, how much ventilation it requires, and you know, the correct procedure for changing toner cartridges to minimise the escape of little particles into the air.
Well, I'm off to read my printer manual. In the meantime, let's talk to Henry from Hampton in Middlesex. Henry has a printer question, don't you, Henry? Good morning.
Hi, yes, I do indeed, yes. A bit of a challenge, really. Inkjet printer.
Yep.
Basic situation, I spend a lot of time on a boat where I don't have a landline, so I use a mobile Wi-Fi device.
Yep.
Familiar with those, yeah?
Yep, absolutely.
This is a device that came from EE. It's an Alcatel. Supposedly supports up to 32 devices.
Yes.
I connect all sorts of things to it. But I recently changed my printer to an HP 3630, a new product release, which is all they go on about is how wireless it is.
Yes.
And it won't connect. Well, I say it won't. It occasionally connects, but it's it's very weird. If you look at the list of devices, when you enter sort of the Wi-Fi thing, you know, in the bottom sort of right-hand corner of a mobile, a Windows 10 screen, it lists devices there, and it doesn't show up.
It doesn't see it.
I have to say, this is a bit of a change, because I've actually spent about 3 hours on the phone to, especially the first time I was an Irishman sitting in a desk in Barcelona from Hewlett Packard.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't solve the problem. I've had another guy called Kevin who spent a lot of time with me on it. Nobody seems to be able to get to the bottom of it. It's whether you're familiar with these things, there seems to be a conflict somewhere where if I connect the print, if it does see the printer and I just connect it, it disconnects the internet from the main sort of wireless router.
Mm. So you're using effectively what might generically be called a MiFi device. So it's got a SIM card in it. It gets the internet in via mobile internet and it disseminates it as a Wi-Fi
it's
signal.
It's kind of like a dedicated tethering device.
Yeah. It's a hotspot. It's a mobile hotspot.
That's right. Well, yeah.
I mean, do you own a smartphone?
Yes, I've got a couple of them, yeah.
Okay. Most smartphones can be used in a similar way, and I'm not suggesting you do this as a permanent solution, but I think it would be an interesting experiment to set your smartphone up as a personal hotspot and see if it recognises that. If it doesn't recognise that, then that would tend to suggest the problem is with the printer. In that, you know, here are two independent Wi-Fi signals that it doesn't recognise.
Yeah.
Does the printer recognise any other Wi-Fi signals that might be bouncing around the area?
Does the printer recognise any others?
Yes. So the
not
printer.
Not quite sure how I detect that.
So you're trying to access.
I've got a laptop.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. The laptop.
When I use the laptop, I want to print a document, say, from the laptop.
Right.
So I then go to the list of printers. Say you open the document, it says print, and then you get a list of the printers available. Click on that, doesn't see it, says not connected or whatever.
Yeah, but do the devices see one another? I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. It's quite weird. When I first set, HP sent me a second one of these because the first one didn't work properly.
Yes.
And the second one came up with, when I first installed it, came up and said open, whereas the previous ones had just said connect, secure.
Right.
And then it kind of lost the plot a bit.
So with the difference between open and secure is that the secure is, it means that the wireless communication is encrypted, it's encoded, and that's what it should be for safety reasons. But it also means that then you have to enter the correct password to be access it.
Sure.
Open might be good as an experiment to see if it's physically capable of connecting, but it's not how you should use the device. When you spoke to HP, did they look at the possibility of updating the software inside the device?
We've done all that. Yeah, we've downloaded that. I mean, one of the issues we thought about was whether it was to do with Windows 10 drivers and things like that. But
it could be. The device came with Windows 10 on it. Yes.
I upgraded the laptop to Windows 10, but the device supposedly connects to every flavour of Windows going.
It's a fairly new model of printer as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's only been on the market for 2 or 3 months.
Yeah. But it could still be a dry...
White, pale blue, all looks very sexy, but doesn't do the job. What was interesting as well is that when you went through the process of installing it, it says, hang on a minute, connect via a USB cable and I'll download the software I need.
Yeah.
And it tries, and then it doesn't see the USB cable.
Oh, that doesn't sound like...
My friend Kevin at HP this afternoon did actually manage to get it talking through the USB, even though it doesn't appear to.
Yeah.
You know, when you plug it in, you don't get the normal... You know, when you plug in a USB device, you get some sort of tone.
I'm liking the sound of this less and less, Henry, because I was thinking when we were purely talking about wireless that, you know, that it's possible there's interference and it's causing this sort of choppy behavior of it recognizing it and then not recognizing it. But that tends to suggest that there might be a problem either with the hardware or at least the drivers within it. If they're saying to you you're running the latest version of the drivers and that they are those drivers are compatible with your hardware, then I think it's incumbent upon them to either resolve your problem or send you another one to try.
I agree. I just thought it was just an outside.
No, the fact that
you might have some bright ideas, but
no. I don't, Henry, because the fact that it's seeing it at all, it's working a bit, tells us quite a lot. It tells us that it's flaky rather than in need of the correct password or what have you.
I think it's the printer rather than anything else. I mean, like the USB port thing, I can connect mobile phones, external disk drives, and all sorts of things to it.
I think that's right, because that's a new bit of kit on the block, as it were. And even if it's not a fault, it may be an incompatibility. Still, I think if all your other kit is working, I think that's quite a powerful argument to say, you know, fix it or replace it or refund it.
Henry, thanks very much for giving us a call. Best of luck with that one, mate. It does sound like it might be a dodgy printer, so perhaps it's back off to HP with that one. 0500 999 693. Got about 10 minutes left to get your calls into Fevzy. David in Warrington sent us a text on 85058 Fevzy. I'm a bit jealous of David in Warrington, to be honest with you. He has a 6th generation Core i7 processor. He's currently got 16 gig of DDR4 memory, and he's wondering whether it's worth the upgrade to 32 gig.
Okay. Well,
so that's a meaty PC, isn't it?
Yes, so 6th generation, that's a reasonably modern. We're up to the 7th now, but not a big difference between the 6th and the 7th. There are only limited number of uses where 32 gig is an appreciable and worthwhile upgrade. So with memory, it's kind of diminishing returns. So when you go from sort of 1 to 2 gig, 2 to 4, to a lesser extent 4 to 8, you see real noticeable tangible differences, and it's because you can have more tabs open at once on your browser, more programs running at the same time. But once you get past 8, you're really talking about, at the moment, specialist uses. And one specialist use, for example, might be if you were running virtual machines, so you were running effectively an operating system within an operating system in a box on its own. If you're doing that, and then you need to have enough memory for each operating system to run and have resources not only to processor but to RAM. Other uses may be if you're doing things like video editing and you want to be able to have large video files sitting in RAM memory so that you can edit it more quickly, because it's not having to stream off a drive, although with SSDs that's less of an issue. These solid state drives are a good deal quicker. So if you're running a sort of fairly specialist application, then yes, fine. Otherwise, I wouldn't necessarily bother. It just means that it will take a little bit longer to boot up, a little bit longer to shut down, a little bit more to go wrong with it. Consume a touch more power. You could probably benchmark it, that's to say measure the performance using an app and see some small benefit, but you probably wouldn't notice it for average use, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've got 16 gig. Mine's an older machine. It's not as fancy a processor. It's far older, but I've 16 gig of RAM, and the only thing that kills it from a memory point of view is when I run Adobe Lightroom, which I do a lot with a big photo library, and that thing just sucks RAM.
Yeah.
So it depends, I guess, doesn't it, whether you're doing that kind of specific thing. But general usage, not really worth it. But
no, and it also, it could engender bad habits. I tend to have like 200 browser tabs open in my browser, and that's not great.
I do as we speak.
That's not great, because that really does, you know, if you look at how much, if you've got a couple of hundred tabs open, and then try and find the one that's making sound, it's not always easy, you know. You know, in a way, sort of, it's like having a slightly more disciplined approach is not necessarily a bad thing either. So I think you're unlikely to see the benefit, but you know, if you like your tech, it doesn't hurt, I guess. But
sometimes it's just bragging rights, isn't it? Come on, especially with PCs, there's a bit of a one-upmanship sort of thing going on.
Sometimes there can. I mean, depending on the actual sort of the main circuit board, the motherboard, sometimes there can be data throughput advantages to higher density RAM, but it's not always the case, and you'd have to study the specs. And again, it's something that benchmarks would pick up, but not necessarily noticeable in the real world.
We were talking about remote controls earlier with the texter who had a problem with their Sony remote control also controlling their Panasonic TV. DM has texted on 85058 to say, could my TV be affected by a next-door neighbour's remote? Sometimes my TV goes off for no reason. So that would imply, I guess, that there's no line of sight if they're next door.
Unless there's a hole in the wall. Assuming that your television works from radio frequency interference, it's not very likely. There are other things like light bulbs and so forth that sometimes go rogue and produce infrared and can interfere with devices. You can also be, it depends what you mean by going off. If it goes off for a couple of seconds and then comes back on again, and for example it happens when you're watching Freeview, then the problem may be that you're getting interference from the 4G mobile phone network, who some of whose frequencies are dangerously close to Freeview's. If that is the case, if that pattern fits, then you can get filters that you can attach to between the TV set and the aerial input that will filter out the pulse that comes from the 4G mobile phone network. And you can get them for free. I'm trying to remember what it is. It's something like 8880 or something, or 8080. There's an organization which is funded by the mobile phone companies, and they have a certain amount of money to send out free filters. But if you can't get hold of them, then a free filter is typically less than a tenner.
At 800, 800.tv is the website.
Thank you very much for that. So they'll give away free, you just ring them up, they'll send you a free one or two.
Check it out online as well. Jack in Brighton, we've got time for one more call. Jack in Brighton's given us a call. Jack, thanks very much for getting in touch with us. You've got an email problem, Jack.
Yes. Hi, Fevzy.
Hello there.
I've forwarded an email to someone.
Yeah.
And it's got some information, it's got some attachments, etc.
Yeah.
And they now seem to be getting multiple copies of this same email continuously.
Yeah.
Right. I'm using Microsoft Outlook.
Yeah.
And I've had a quick look on the internet to see, and there's some suggestions about that it could be to do with the email having a large attachment, and it doesn't think it sent it, and it keeps resending and this sort of thing.
Yes.
And I just wondered whether you'd heard, before I start trying various things, whether you had any more definite idea about it.
Jack, I've had this happen to me with Outlook, and how long has it been happening to you?
It's just happened in the last day. The email's got a sort of a 10 megabyte attachment.
Yeah.
And basically, the email, they're getting a copy of the same email continuously for hours, you know, every few minutes or every 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, they get another copy of the email.
Yes.
And as far as I can see, it's not in my outbox anymore.
It's in sent items, is it?
I'm not sure. Was it in the sense? I'm not sure if it. I think I've deleted it from there. But it's I'm not sure if it was even in sent items or whatever. But it's not in the outbox anymore. But they're still getting.
I'm sorry to cut you, just because I'm just aware of the time. Do they still continue to get copies of the email if you shut your machine down?
Not when they shut the machine down.
When
Outlook is still, when the machine started up and the Outlook is started up, they start getting copies again.
Yeah, I don't think the 10 megabyte attachment is too small to be the cause of the the problem. Yeah. I would just try making sure it's not in the outbox, which is that sort of limbo between hitting send and going to sent items. Make sure that it's not still in there. If it's in there, delete it. And try and send a blank email to them with no attachments and no substantial text, and see if you can clear through the problem. Failing that, you can also speak to your email provider and see if there's anything that they can do to purge the system, because it could be coming not just from your machine, but it could be coming from the mail server directly. So it's worth checking that as well. In my experience, this problem goes away by itself, and I wouldn't try and change too many settings, because what tends to happen is you change all the settings on your email, the problem goes away by itself, and then all your settings are wrong. So I counsel some patients. I know that's not very good for the recipient, but it is quite telling that it's happening with only one email to one recipient. So try and purge it from your device, and try and send something else in between to that person.
Okay, then.
If for nothing else, just for variety.
Jack, thanks very much for giving us a call. That's Jack in Brighton. He's our last caller this morning, Fevzi. Fevzi, thank you so much for being with us for the last 90 minutes. I'm sorry we interrupted you for that breaking news from Richmond. But
absolute pleasure. It was fascinating.
Oh, it's been a delight to have you on, and you've helped so many people as ever. And Fevzi's website, gadgetdetective.com. If you've got any more questions, head on there and you can get in touch with Fevzi.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.